Senate Bill 164 first, because we have someone that has a scheduling conflict. We'll try and pick up Senate Bill 18, hopefully that will be, won't take long. And then we'll go back to Senate Bill 115. We'll probably break after that. We're going to come back at 2 o'clock on Senate Bill 148, and the other bills we'll be taking up sometime after we take up Senate Bill 148, so everyone knows what the schedule is. So that brings us back to Senate Bill 164. Do we have a sign-up sheet on 164? Commissioner, join us.
164.
Okay, this is a bill by the request of the governor. We have the transmittal letter in the file. We have John Bradley signed up to testify. Well, he signed up to testify, but then he said respond to questions. He doesn't want to testify. But
Chairman,
I'll just give us a brief overview of the bill.
All right. Mr. Chairman, my name is John Shively. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. This bill would authorize a contract between the state of Alaska and Tesoro for 40,000 barrels of royalty oil. Tesoro has had one or more contracts for royalty oil with the state since 1980. They are, as you know, they have a refinery in Nikiski, which employs 189 people. They employ 500 people statewide. We think that this contract is a good contract. It's received really no opposition in either the public hearing process that we went through. It has passed through the House, passed out of the House yesterday, 38-0. The oil is priced at what we call an Exxon price, which is a slight premium over what we could have gotten. But we think it's fair because the Exxon price is less of a risk for Tesoro. There's also a letter of credit that protects the state in case Tesoro ceases to take the oil. The reason it's in front of you is that my predecessor had extended their previous contract for 1 year. That was all that could be extended. So we had to do a new contract, and new contracts go in front of the legislature. And so this bill is here for your approval, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sharp?
Yeah, through the chair, John, Commissioner. Well, what's the length of the term that has to be covered by letter of credit? I know the old contract, I think it used to be 90 days, and then there was some hassle about increasing that administratively or on the extension 120 or 140 or something. Do you know offhand what that is?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharp, the letter of credit currently is 75 days, under the current contract it's 60 days.
Okay.
We have increased it to 75 days with a provision that if they can give us some assurances, we can put it back down to 60 days. It's sort of complicated. It has to do with if they stop taking our oil, we have to notify the oil companies to take it, and we have a period to do that. And during that period, they don't have to take our oil. One of the times that we were faced with that, with the Alpetco contract, the industry took our oil but charged us a big premium to do it. So this letter of credit is designed to protect us in case they stop buying oil and the industry won't take it at full price.
Because you have to nominate
We have to nominate the producers ahead of time. That's correct.
So, but yeah, okay. I'd heard that they were trying to increase it 50% on the last contract. And letters of credit, as you well know, are fairly expensive. If they've got a good credit reference or a good credit history with the state, sort of doesn't seem like the thing to. What is the? I know some of the other royalty contracts, if I may, Mr. Chairman, calls for payment. For instance, I think there's one or two out there that says whatever the price is plus 50 cents a barrel. Is there? We charge our in-state refiners more than we can get on the open market for it. But I don't have a. I just can never understand it.
What does this say?
You said something about the Exxon price plus or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharp, we only have one outstanding contract right now, and that's with MAPCO, and that's a long-term contract, and I believe that's based on what we call the BP price without a premium. This contract is based on the Exxon price, which is slightly higher than the BP price, but there is no premium. The last time we had a contract with a premium was with Tesoro. There was a 25-cent premium. They never bought any oil under that contract.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, but choosing the Exxon price versus the BP price is a premium, is it not?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, it is higher. It's a slight premium, but there is a benefit to Tesoro. The BP price is subject to audit because BP's transportation costs are actual and have to be audited by us, whereas Exxon's transportation prices are a set fee. And what happens, of course, if we go in and audit BP, find out they underpaid us, then Tesoro, as they did in the Amarana Hus case, has to come back and pay us for fuel they've already sold, and that could be as late as 6 years down the road. So the Exxon price, although a little bit higher than the BP price, gives them less risk, and therefore we thought the premium was justified. In addition, Mr. Chairman, the BP price may become almost like the Exxon price either after the Exxon, the export ban is lifted, or if the West Coast begins to take all the oil, which it will at some point.
Now, some of the earlier contracts were based on the weighted average price.
Chairman, you're getting into an area that I'm not as familiar with in our economists right here. All our prices are weighted averages, as I understand them.
I mean, overall weighted average, not by by producer.
No, that's correct. And each, as we settled the Amarada Hess case, we came up with different ways to deal with each of the people we settled with, which ought to be a lot of fun in the future. But anyway, this is one of those.
Your testimony initially was 500 jobs. Is that kind of what you said? What was the number of jobs said?
Statewide, they employ 552. That includes their service stations, the people that operate the pipeline. The refinery itself is 189 people out of that.
And this will be their only royalty contract now?
Yes. They process about 50,000 barrels. 40,000 barrels comes from us. The other 10,000 barrels comes out of Cook Inlet.
Okay, 50,000 barrels. And what is the difference in cents per barrel between the BP price and the Exxon price?
That varies.
Well, just give me a guess. 10 cents, 5 cents, 8 cents?
They said 19 cents. I think it probably varies from about 5 to 19. We tried to do it at about, we were trying to hit about 14 or 15 cents a barrel was good.
So for a premium of somewhere maybe averaging 15 cents, we're getting 500 jobs. I was trying to figure out, because now if we passed the royalty reduction bill and the royalty were actually reduced, I'm trying to figure out what the equation is and does it affect this contract? If the royalty reduction reduces the average or the overall price the state is getting, does it reduce the price this contract gets as well?
I don't think it would. The royalty, let's see, how does that work? I think the answer is no, the royalty would not affect it. And even if it affected it, it would be fairly insignificant because you're talking about one, you know, sort of a small field with still a large amount of oil. But it's based on the price, and you're getting really beyond my abilities. I can bring in our economist who isn't here if you're interested in that, but I do not believe that would have any effect on this price here.
Well, I mean, I support this contract. I'm just trying to figure out how it actually works in terms of the details.
And Senator, when we get back to the royalty incentive bill, we can revisit that issue. I would be happy to get an answer to that question.
Okay. Senator Rieger?
On that point, it seems to me that it wouldn't affect the sale because the royalty reduction, as I understand it, means you take less oil, not that you take oil at a lower price. So in either event, you're selling 40,000 barrels of oil to Tesoro, and it might be a 40,000 piece of a smaller pool, but it's still the same 40,000 and the same valuation per barrel. It's just,
I think the value, you know, the pool changes based on what you take in kind versus take in value, but the price is based on the overall in value price, and if the overall in value price is reduced by a component at 3% royalty while the other components are at 12% royalty, then there may be some, that's what I was trying to figure out.
Okay. But, Mr. Chairman, I did have a couple questions.
Go ahead.
First, just, I remember reading the governor's original press release on this, and I believe the press release said that the majority of oil is sold in this way, but that's, I was hoping that wasn't the case. Not hoping, but I assume that wasn't the case.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, we currently have, as I said, one other contract with MAPCO. That's for 30,000 barrels. This is 40,000 barrels. We have another 108,000 barrels that available to us. Of that, we use about 18,000 barrels to pay our field costs for lifting the royalty oil. So this...
Yeah, it's a small, really small. As I read the contract and you listen to your testimony, the value of this oil is determined by the value of Exxon oil, and there is references in the contract to litigation on the valuation of oil. Is this a, is the value of the Exxon oil determinant, or is it still in the courts as to how it will be valued?
There is no litigation at this point in the courts about how it will be valued. That's okay. Not to say, and we think because of the settlements that we have, will not have further litigation, but I cannot promise there'll be no further litigation.
But this, so this isn't like the old royalty deal. That, and would this have the potential to come back and hit with a retroactive charge the way that, wasn't it MAPCO and Tesoro got hit a year or two ago?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, both MAPCO and Tesoro got hit with charges as a result of the Amerada Hess settlement. There is some potential for that, but it is pretty minimal.
Okay. That's all.
The fear in that area, particularly with regard to Tesoro in the past, was that their accrued liability got to the point where it threatened to overtake their net worth. Are you sure that the way this is set up, we can't get that far behind again? Because my concern is that we want to keep the competition in the marketplace, we want to keep them producing, but sometimes if you set up a situation, you get yourself in a choice of either enforcing your contract and destroying your alternative, or not enforcing your contract and giving the money away after the fact.
Chairman, we and Tesoro both believe that will not happen, that we are protected.
You won't get $100 million behind.
Chairman, there's not that much risk right now in the price difference.
Questions by other members of the committee? Senator Jarrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this three-year proposed contract that you have, looking at the conclusion, it just, as a policy matter, it's a successful program, it's a technical matter. It goes through it. The contract gives the state a premium price, and then, as Rossman says, it provides the state with ample flexibility to respond to changes in the ANS market. What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Zaroff, the one major change that we can see potentially in the market is the lifting of the export ban, and that could change the pricing. We have the ability to reopen the contract if that happens, so that's what that refers to.
Thank you.
Further questions? We don't have anybody else signed up to testify. We have, I assume he's just on the line, either listening or whatever. We have Bernie Smith from Tesoro online. We have him on?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. This is Bernie.
Do you have any testimony?
I'm here to answer any questions if the chairman or the committee have any questions. I'll be happy to answer.
Are there any questions by members of the committee? No questions here, just keep making gas.
Salary reasonable rate.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for not being at the committee. I didn't realize our system worked so fast.
Well, it doesn't work that fast. It's a kind of this time of year is hurry up and wait. And so we apologize for the scheduling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just right.
Could we have a motion on the bill? Senator Donnelly?
Move the bill with individual recommendations.
We have a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Are there objections? Without objection, the bill is moved out of committee with individual recommendations.
The
It's a Zorro Salamaco gas, huh?
Yep. Let's try and deal with a major piece of legislation on Senate Bill 18. Senator Jara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Jara of Senate District C, and what you have before you is Senate Bill 18, which is a bill that we dealt with last year, almost made it through the process. What the bill does is it allows for REAAs to have placed on the ballot an advisory question. Currently, right now, if you have a municipal school district like a Burlesville, the Borough Assembly can make the decision as to whether you want to put a question on the ballot or not that pertains to education. We had a question here in one of the southeast island school district that came up, and they wanted to put the question on the ballot, and we checked with the Division of Elections. There was no mechanism that allowed them to do this, and so we introduced the bill last year to allow this to happen, and it did not pass, so we're reintroducing it again this year. There were a couple of concerns that came up in the interim, and on line 6, we inserted the words after question and before the word B, relating to education, so that the question on the ballot would have to relate to education. And I thought that that satisfied the concerns of the CRA chairman.
Yeah, we're getting
also the department had a question on there as a concern that they had, an advisory question. The last sentence, an advisory question was authorized under this subsection, may not consist of more than 100 words and shall be worded in a manner that allows an advisory question to be answered with a yes or no. We had hoped that there a new CS would have come over, changing a yes or no to an amendment that I would propose to this, to a CS if it were adopted by the committee, that would change yes to favor the question and no to oppose the question. And so, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would offer a CS by the Finance Committee to be our working document before us.
We have a proposed Finance CS. Does every member have it? It's 9LSO266/C-check.
I have a question.
If there are no objections?
No.
If there are no objections, the proposed Finance CS is adopted and before us for discussion. Senator Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I just don't want to nitpick this, but I do want to ask the question on, you know, education is kind of wide berth. I guess I know what your intent is, but other people who are going out and getting petitions may, I can see an argument being made that maybe Alaska Public Broadcasting should be put on this on the ballot because it's relating to education. I've heard that a million times, being the subcommittee chairman on Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission. That's the only reason I'm bringing it up. I don't want to nitpick it, but I know what your intent is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Phillips, we tried to address it as much as we could by inserting the words relating to education, and that the regional school board would still have to adopt the resolution. Yeah, and you know, I'm sure that they're going to use quite a bit of discretion in doing that.
I just thought I'd bring it up.
No, what was
Senator Jarrett, do you wish to offer an amendment to your CS?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would offer amendment number 1, which is in your packet. Changes yes to the phrase to favor the question, and it changes no on line 13 to insert to oppose the question.
Okay, so it would read in context, shall be worded in a manner that allows advisory question to be answered with a yes to favor the question, with a no to oppose the question. Are there objections to the adoption of that amendment? Without objection, that amendment is adopted. The bill is before us for action.
Mr. Chairman?
It has a very serious fiscal note, $700.
Huh? 118.
Which is the cost of printing an additional ballot card for one REAA election. I expect this may run away from us, and we may get 2 or 3 of those $700 things
supplementing shortly,
but it probably is within the capacity of the department.
I would think so.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Schar.
What was the intentions on the CS we adopted? Was that changed verbally to after on line 7 after question to say relating to education before we adopted it, or?
It says relating to education.
On line 6.
On line 6?
Yeah. After the first question.
Okay,
question.
I was looking under the word question on line 7. Okay. There we go.
It is related to education. We hope it is closely related. Senator Phillips is not concerned with the third cousin questions being tied to education.
Maybe the fourth cousin.
We might want to add related within the first degree of kindred or whatever. We have a motion on the bill.
Oh, there's going to be people.
Chairman, I would move the move committee substitute for Senate Bill 18, Finance, as amended.
We have a motion to move out committee substitute Senate Bill 18, Finance, amended. Are there objections? It won't be a Finance amended. It'll be a new CS.
New CS.
Without objection, the bill is moved from committee with individual recommendations. That brings us to Senate Bill 115, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act.
What are we doing? Where are you uniforming?
Does that sound like a federal mandate, huh?
Yeah, unpadded. No.
Well, repealing one and adopting another one. I don't know whose mandate is whose.
That'd be good. Saturday morning.
We have a proposed finance CS, but I believe the only difference is the title, which just tightened up the title, is all.
15.
This is by request of the governor. We have some trouble already. Director of CSED. Go ahead.
I'm still Glenda Straube, Director of Child Support Enforcement. The most difficult cases for us to collect for our interstate cases, and that is 44% of our caseload. In fact, non-custodial parents know that crossing state lines is a very easy way to avoid supporting kids. And Senate Bill 115 will provide a tremendous tool for us to collect in those cases. There are a lot of problems, but probably the major part of 115 that's important to all of us and to your constituents is to eliminate the multiple order system. For instance, somebody can move to Alaska and one person's got an order in Ohio, another's got an order in Mississippi, and there really is no clear guidelines on which order to use. So this would eliminate the multiple order system. It would clarify the continuing and exclusive jurisdiction, the state of continuing exclusive jurisdiction.
How does it do that?
I mean,
that's a great statement. How do you get that done? You're
well,
orders of three other states and taking ours.
It's wherever the original order was done, and as long as one of the parties, either the obligor, the obligee, or the children, is still in that state, that is the continuing exclusive jurisdiction. That's not the case now. You can move to another, one party can move to another state and try and get an order. Meanwhile, that other party's somewhere else and they get an order and then they move again. And so this would be as long as any one of the parties remained in that original state, that is the order that would be in effect.
Now this applies to all the conditions, or this applies to child support payments? Does this apply to custody, all the other provisions, or how does this work?
No, this is a child support bill.
Just child support.
Right. Uh-huh. We don't deal with custody, so.
And this works with other states are adopting it in the same way?
Yes, about 20-something states have adopted it. It's another one of those federal mandates. That it used to be ERISA, and then they've cleaned it up, and now it's called UIFSA.
How is it a federal mandate?
Well, basically, they tell us that we have to get it passed, or as usual, they tell us if we don't get it passed, we eventually don't get our funding. So,
what is the time limit of this mandate?
Next century.
I should know that. I think it was last year.
Okay.
But
I'll stop interrupting and let you go ahead and go through the bill.
Well, good. Those are good questions.
I should let you have a shot first, and I'll come back and try to remember the question.
Basically provides a long-arm jurisdiction. It's easier, going to be easier to reach out-of-state obligors. It's going to provide efficiency because all interstate cases are going to have to start using the same federal forms. We're going to be using a particular interstate computer network. It allows for special evidentiary rules to speed up the introduction of evidence. And it allows for direct income withholding. Basically, it is a great improvement over the past. There is no cost, there are no additional operating expenditures. We do expect increased revenues of approximately $340,000 per year for the state's share of AFDC reimbursement, and $600,000 to $700,000 that go directly to children.
Senator Phillips?
The long arm includes foreign jurisdictions, right?
I'm sorry?
Your long arm includes foreign jurisdictions?
I believe that it does.
Why don't we just, instead of saying state means, why don't we say jurisdictions means da-da-da-da-da?
If I might, Marilyn May is online from the AG's office. She can better answer some of those questions.
Marilyn, are you on? Could we turn you up?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Fairly. Thank you. I didn't quite hear the question.
Okay, this is Randy Phillips. On page 3, line 22, you got state means. Why don't we just say jurisdiction means?
The reason for that is in the bill, when it's talking about state, for instance, the tribunal of a state, it's just telling that it means not only the actual states, but also the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and D.C. and so on.
Right, I understand that. But this also, the long arm also includes foreign jurisdiction, right?
Well, that's what long arm jurisdiction always means. This is the reason that you need a long arm is to reach someone that's in another state. So the long arm provisions actually just codify what's already Alaska law through case law. They're pretty much identical to the existing case law, and it is they're broad provisions to reach people that have had some kind of a connection with this state who are no longer resident here.
What?
I don't think she heard you.
I don't get what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I said, okay, maybe it's too early in the morning, or maybe we've just been working a lot of hours here, but the question I asked of Linda was, the long arm jurisdiction includes foreign countries. And she said, yes.
Oh. Okay. I'm sorry. My question was,
instead of saying state, why don't you just say jurisdiction means the state of the United States, or a state of the United States? And go on from there.
Well, I think that on page 3 at line 23, when it's defining state, it's not really talking about jurisdiction, but rather, for instance, when it says the term state includes a foreign jurisdiction that's established procedures and so on, I think what they're saying there is that in a case where, say, Canada has similar child support enforcement laws, if they do, then we could have the same kind of reciprocal agreements with Canada and determining which one has continuing exclusive jurisdiction. That's a separate thing from the long-arm jurisdiction portion of the statute, which is meant to obtain personal jurisdiction over a person who's no longer here. I think the definition of state is talking about how you're going to apply child support orders or enforce child support orders from other states and countries. Did that make sense?
Yes.
Senator Rieger?
Are you through with your presentation of the bill?
Yes.
Is this language exactly identical to the language adopted in the other states you referred to?
there was a uniform language, and each state, some states have adopted it in whole. The most of the states have adopted in whole. Others have adopted, have taken pieces here and there, or taken a piece out, or whatever, but most of them have adopted it in whole. And yes, it was a, I'm trying to think, a committee of which organization that came up with the language. Thank you.
Yeah,
That's scary.
Looking at, I'm trying to figure out how this works, but I think maybe the heart of it is in page 6. What happens is that each state has jurisdiction unless another state not only gets to the person first, but also everybody who's a party to it agrees that the other state has jurisdiction. Is that a fair summary of how I read, oh, say lines 5 through 12 on page 6? Yeah, maybe I'd ask it to the AG.
Yeah. Could you restate the question, please?
Okay, what, could you please interpret page 6, lines 5 through 12 for me?
Yes, it's saying that once a child support order is issued by an Alaskan tribunal, which includes either the court or CSED, then it retains exclusive jurisdiction over that order, and no other state can modify it or issue a conflicting order so long as one of the three parties, either the custodial parent or the non-custodial parent, which are called the obligee and the obligor, or the child still remains in Alaska. Or even if they're still here, they could consent to have another state modify the order or issue a new order.
Okay, I think I follow. So the only way that the long arm that Glenn Estravi was referring to operates is if you get there first before the state, which is the residence of the obligor, has taken action.
I think maybe I should explain the two. It's unfortunate that they use the word jurisdiction for both concepts. It's really two different things going on. The long-arm jurisdiction provisions relate to how you can get a person into your court, even though they don't live there. Normally, the courts, or in this case, tribunal also includes the agency, could only have the authority or the power to make an order that requires someone to do something if they live here in this jurisdiction. Under long-arm statutes like the one in UIFSA, which are common in other types of law too, the Alaska Tribunal can make an order, this is the original order, over a person who doesn't live here. Normally, the common way that this would be happening is, for instance, if a mother and child are still in Alaska and the father has left, Alaska can make an order that requires the father to pay child support even though he's in another state by using the long-arm jurisdiction. That is the means for the tribunal to get personal jurisdiction over that person. Once they have personal jurisdiction through the long-arm statute, then they can go ahead and issue the order. Then comes into effect this language on page 6 regarding continuing exclusive jurisdiction. And that is the court's jurisdiction or the agency's jurisdiction over the order itself, whether they have the power to do, to enforce or modify that order. And it, and that comes into play when where the, say, the Alaska Tribunal that issued the original order can enforce it and modify it if one of the parties still lives here or if all the parties consent.
Okay, I think I'm starting to follow it.
So those are really two separate issues.
Now, what, I guess the main, just a philosophical question that I have, and I haven't had a chance to read all the detail in here, but in the event of a of an erroneous action on the part of the tribunal, which is not just a court, but as you described, it's an agency. What court has jurisdiction for damages or remedies for the erroneous actions of the agency?
Okay, if it's an agency action to begin with, if through the provisions of this law, if the agency adopts a child support order or enforces it in a way that's not appropriate, the person has an opportunity to appeal that through the agency's normal hearing procedures to an informal and then a formal conference and then to the court if they're not satisfied, to the Alaska Superior Court and to the Supreme Court if that doesn't satisfy someone.
So if you live in Idaho, your appeals are all in Alaska?
Yes.
At what point can you appeal to a federal court or your own court if, let's say, that a state is just all screwed up and they practically conspire to misuse the system?
Well, I suppose you could, if the appeals process isn't working, a person could theoretically bring an original action. That would be file a complaint in a court. And generally, federal jurisdiction the federal court could have jurisdiction either if there's a federal law at stake and if the Congress does mandate this. Through the federal child support laws, it's possible that they would have that jurisdiction. Or alternatively, because the parties are in two different states, the federal court can assume jurisdiction. So if there was really a state that was messing up pretty seriously, a person could file some kind of a complaint or for either injunctive relief or a civil rights action if that was appropriate or whatever in a federal court or in their own state court potentially.
Okay. Well, it just is the part of the testimony or the bill that I've seen that leaves me uncomfortable is that you actually could be subject to proceedings thousands of miles away that could be pretty hard for you to contest if, in fact, you are being treated unfairly.
Well, actually, that's true. I think it's more true under current law. The multiple order system that Ms. Straube alluded to is a situation where two people who may once have lived presumably once lived in the same state, say they lived in Alaska, and there's an Alaska child support order, and then one of them moves to Montana and one moves to Wyoming. The way it is now, under current law, they could each be getting child support orders in their own state, so there could be three. There could be even more sometimes. And whichever state the obligor is living in usually is the one that is actually doing the collecting. And they can sort of either pick and choose or create their own order. And different states could be collecting different amounts. One state could be going after an IRS refund while another state's going after wages and so on. And the amounts of the orders aren't generally not identical because the states have different standards. So a person's already in that position of having to defend in various states. Under this UIFSA, the person can tell which state will have continuing exclusive jurisdiction. That state only has jurisdiction because of the context that the individual has had. It's generally because they either the child was either conceived in that state. I'm talking about the long-arm jurisdiction now. For instance, Alaska can only have long-arm jurisdiction over an obligor in another state if he had certain contact with Alaska. For instance, if the child was conceived here or if the parties lived here and so on. So it's not like some state that has nothing to do with this person is asserting any rights over him. It's just that there has to be one state that has the power to do that, and you can't allow somebody to escape their responsibility by moving to another state and saying it's too difficult to defend.
Okay.
Senator Rieger, you?
Maybe I'll let someone else ask a couple questions. You know, I'm looking through, I'm listening to her, and I'm looking at page four, second half of the page, the jurisdiction, bases for jurisdiction over non-resident. And just, you know, I'm not really thinking of the people who move away after they've been into a child support order situation, but the first notice that kind of comes out of the blue, and you got to respond, and it means you got to fly from Idaho to Alaska to respond. And maybe that isn't happening. I'm just trying to make sure that there's not, that there's enough protection for the innocent along what they're trying to accomplish, which is to, you know, catch people.
May I respond?
Go ahead.
Sure.
I wanted to note that in the first place, this, as I said, this jurisdiction, basis for jurisdiction over non-resident on page four is pretty much identical to what the current state of Alaska's law is. We already can assert jurisdiction over a non-resident in any type of an action on that type of basis. And secondly, that this law does allow telephonic participation and tries to make it easier for people in other states to participate. For instance, on page 15 at line 6, it says that a tribunal of this state may permit a party residing in another state to testify by telephone. And at line 9, a tribunal of the state shall cooperate with tribunals of other state in designating an appropriate location for the testimony. So, for instance, the child support agency here could assist the child support agency in another state or vice versa with getting testimony and so on. It's meant to be easier on the parties by allowing electronic testimony by telephone or other electronic means.
That language seems to be permissive instead of a requirement. Why doesn't it say the tribunal shall permit a party or witness residing in another state to respond in that manner?
I don't know why they chose to draft it that way. I don't know. I can't imagine that a tribunal of this state would not permit it, particularly in Alaska, where it's very common already, both in the courts and in most agencies, to allow telephonic testimony. The court rules permit it.
That is that's how we operate now. Yeah.
Would somebody go through the special evidentiary rules that are different than the rules of evidence for other issues?
Okay. That's starting on line 16 at page 14.
Page 14, line 16.
Yes. The at A, where it says the physical presence of the petitioner is not required, I think in most situations that probably is the same as the current status, which is if the petitioner lives in Ohio, they don't necessarily have to come back here to deal with establishment, enforcement, or modification of a child support order. I don't think normally they would. B is it's just again, most of these, Alaska is pretty lenient with evidence because of the difficulties and the distances that are involved here. I think that generally, B is pretty close to the current status as well. The federally mandated forms are an attempt to just make it more uniform throughout the country so that each child support agency doesn't have to determine whether the documents that came from another state comply with the local rules and laws. C.
Thank you.
C, D, and C and D are pretty close also to the current status, which is that we allow documentary evidence pretty readily. In E, they're saying that you can use a fax copy or a that sort of an electronically transmitted document. Rather than the original. There is an evidence rule called the best evidence rule that requires you to have the original if it's available, but that's often, courts frequently allow a copy to be admitted. So, in fact, that's not too different either. In F, we already talked about that, telephonic participation is allowed, and that's already true in Alaska. In G, there's a rule of evidence that this is sort of talking about, you know, the Fifth Amendment, and it's saying that in this type of a case that taking the Fifth doesn't work. It's they can't really refuse to answer on the grounds that something could be incriminating. It's not like a criminal trial.
Can you elaborate on that? Are you saying that you're prevented from invoking a constitutional right?
Well, that constitutional right deals with criminal trials, that you can't be prosecuted criminally for an action and required to testify against yourself in a criminal prosecution, but this isn't a criminal prosecution.
Can it result in criminal penalties?
Criminal non-support is a whole separate issue. And if a person were prosecuted under the criminal non-support statute, they would have the opportunity to invoke the Fifth Amendment and refuse to testify.
Is this a provision in all the other states that adopted this act?
Yes, this is in the uniform law.
Is it in current law in the state of Alaska?
No, I don't believe so. I think that generally, though, this it's not written down in Alaska law, but I think that this is generally how a court would view that a court can take the witness's testimony, the trier of fact, which may be the judge, or if it were a jury trial, the jury. Or
these things go to juries very often. Isn't this always in front of a judge?
Well, generally, yes. Or in this case, it could be before the agency. And normally in agency or court hearings, as it is, the testimony of a party will be viewed for its credibility, and if a person is saying, I can't answer a question because it could incriminate me, then the court or the agency, the hearing officer, could certainly take that into account as it is. This just puts it in writing that that's the way it will be.
But in a jury trial, the jury never hears the question. Isn't that correct?
No, I don't think that's correct. What question do you mean?
If someone invokes the Fifth Amendment in a jury trial, that question is a question that is, I mean...
No, I think normally in a criminal prosecution where there's a jury, that a question could be asked and a person could say, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may tend to incriminate me. The jury would hear that. Sometimes the criminal defendant will refuse to testify altogether, can choose not to testify at all, and then there wouldn't be any question. But if the person is on the stand, the jury certainly could hear a question to which the response might be, I refuse to answer on the grounds that may tend to incriminate me.
But the jury is instructed that they can't use that, right?
I'm just thinking about it, in a jury trial,
it seems easier to separate the self-incrimination questions, but if it's a judge or a hearing officer, whether it says so in the law, the judge or the hearing officer has a hard time disregarding what he heard.
Right, and I think a jury can too, and I'm sorry, I don't practice criminal law, and I don't really know if a jury would always be instructed.
I thought the Fifth Amendment proceedings usually ended up not being heard by the jury in criminal cases, but I don't know.
No. But this is a civil, in any civil procedure, you don't have the same guarantees that you have in a criminal.
And this is, I'm looking at the commentary to the uniform law, and it notes that this subsection codifies the rule, which is in effect in many states, that in civil litigation an adverse inference may be drawn from a litigant's silence. And I didn't specifically look this up for an Alaska case, but I think that this, it is true in Alaska as well. And then H and I are pretty self-explanatory, and I, currently there can be, between spouses who are still married to each other, there is a privilege where they don't have to be forced to testify against each other. But here that doesn't apply because of the circumstances. And the same with I.
Would you explain the direct income withholding provisions and how they apply to state law, current law?
Yes, currently, if we want to enforce an Alaska order in another state, if the obligor moves to Montana, and we know that he's working in Montana, or she, we use the interstate laws that are currently in effect and send our order to Montana. Montana has to basically create a Montana order out of it before they can go against the wages of the obligor. Under the direct income withholding provisions in UIFSA, the Alaska tribunal, like the child support agency, could send the Alaska order directly to the employer in Montana, and that employer would have to treat it as if it were a Montana order, so that it cuts out a lot of time. And also there's a lot of confusion sometimes, because when one state's order is sent to another state, if they don't get the right number of copies, or if it's something's not a page didn't copyright, or if it wasn't authenticated properly or whatever, and since all the states have different rules, it's pretty common that there can be confusion in that process of getting all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, and then it goes into line in the other state with the other many thousands of cases that they're working on. So there can be a significant time lag, and this is actually one of the most useful aspects of this law, that allows an order from Alaska, or excuse me, from another state to be sent to Alaska, to an Alaska employer, and be directly enforced without going through the agency in the other state.
Article 8 deals with essentially extradition, although it's called rendition for some reason.
Right.
Would you explain how that works and how it compares to existing law?
Well, I'm sorry, that's an excellent question, and I don't know the current extradition law, so I can't really answer that, except that the UIFSA law simply is a simple explanation for the way that a person who is charged criminally with criminal non-support can be extradited to another state. It simply says that our governor can demand that a governor of another state surrender someone, or that a governor of another state can demand that we surrender someone who's charged criminally for non-support.
It just seems that this is a pretty nice provision that I'd almost like to have more in some of the criminal cases that we don't pursue.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a nice, simple way to do that, and it probably is a good idea to do it more broadly.
It seems that things socially acceptable for enforcing child support aren't acceptable for major criminals.
I don't know. It may be just that the uniform law commissioners who drafted this were a little ahead of the curve for the other types of cases.
Thank you.
I'm looking again at the commentary to the uniform law, and it says that this section tracks the revised Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement of Support Act, which is not in effect in Alaska, but it is in some other states, with no substantive change. Virtually no controversy has been generated regarding this portion of the statute.
No controversy, you mean state, or you mean uniform law commissioners, uniform law?
I believe they're saying that none of the states that have this provision have had any problem with it.
The back of this bill has a huge list of repealers. I don't know that it's reasonable to request an analysis of every repealer, but I guess the entry-level question is which are substantive and which are technical.
Well, that whole list of all the, in Section 5, that is the current interstate child support enforcement portion of the statutes, and it's called URESA, which is the Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement of Support Act. And most of them are substantive. That, as I said, there was another, we adopted URESA. There was another uniform act that was the revised URESA or RURESA that some states adopted. And then now UIFSA is the third step, and we're kind of back on step one. We sort of skipped step two. These are substantive, most of these are substantive, but that's what they were trying to get rid of when they drafted UIFSA. Some of them are the same. Some of them are pretty similar to the current law, but the big differences are the continuing exclusive jurisdiction, meaning there can only be one valid order at a time, and the direct income withholding are two of the biggest changes. Those just didn't exist in the earlier law. Previously, under URESA, there could be more than one order that would be enforced at the same time.
Now, I don't know if the legislature wants to even open the question, but is it Rule 90.3 that establishes the actual formula for levels of support?
That's correct.
The court, as I understand it, established that rule not because they intended to take over any area that the legislature was in, but because the legislature never was able to come up with any kind of a set of rules on that area. Am I correct?
I believe that's correct, and the federal funding for the child support program was dependent on getting those guidelines in place, so the court stepped up and did it. May well be in the future that we might request that the legislature take that function back over again.
As I understand it, that's one of those court rules where the court would gladly give it up, although I'm not sure that from the divergent points of view that we could do any better. I know that we get continuous complaints, I've heard complaints that I consider valid from both directions, that the support was too low and that the support was too high. Actually, just because I don't think we've had it anywhere, I would like to get staff to get us, or maybe you can get us a copy of the schedule of 90.3 so that people know what this stuff actually does and is. Are there spousal support orders in Alaska?
I'm sorry, who are you
asking? I believe there are.
Are there spousal support orders in Alaska?
Yes, there are, and those under current law can be enforced by the child support agency if they are in done in conjunction with a child support order, and that continues to be true under UIFSA. The only thing under UIFSA, they can be enforced, but they can't be modified by another state.
Is that required by federal law?
Yes, that's in the Uniform Act. Well, it's in the Uniform Act that the feds are looking at requiring that each state adopt.
Is it common for Alaska to issue support orders?
I don't think they're certainly nowhere near as common as child support orders, but they do occur somewhat regularly.
There is no rule, court rule that applies or any other provision that creates the spousal support provisions?
I think it's case law. I think it's done by case law. What is reasonable has been litigated, and the guidelines are sort of just by looking at what the cases have held.
There seems to be some relationship in this act. There seems to be some references to the establishment of paternity, as well as in the Senate Bill 116. What does this bill do with regard to interstate criteria for the establishment of paternity?
It doesn't set out the criteria for the establishment. It only allows the establishment of what the UIFSA bill does that's different from existing law is that it allows the establishment of paternity administratively, which is also what Senate Bill 116 would do in an intrastate context. And it does not, this UIFSA bill, Senate Bill 115, does not set out the criteria for establishing paternity. That would be done by the by regulation and the other state law. For instance, in AS 2520050D, I believe it is set out the standard that a genetic test result that shows a greater than 95% probability of paternity would be used as evidence of paternity.
The question I have with both bills, and I haven't got an amendment that really satisfies me, is trying to come up with some kind of a safety valve that provides for the disestablishment of paternity where paternity is biologically proven to have been impossible.
Yes, that currently is possible and is done. We have a number of cases in our office where persons who are presumed to be the father of a child for various reasons, like for instance having been married to the mother, have filed an action and sought to disestablish paternity. And it works. They get blood tests, and if it's shown that they're not the father biologically, then often, but not always, the court will disestablish paternity. In some cases, the court has continued to require the person to be the father, even though it's not biologically correct because of the longstanding relationship with the child. Or in one recent case, it was the stepfather who knew all along he wasn't the biological father of the child but had agreed to pay child support, and the Supreme Court just in the last couple of months held that the contract would be applied. He would be held to the contract.
Well, I would agree with that kind of case, because obviously if someone makes a determination to adopt, I think they're making a contract for the support, and if someone knows the situation, they certainly are entering into an obligation that is at least 18 years long, although it's really lifelong. But the ones I'm concerned with are the ones that may
establish paternity by an affirmative statement and then find that there is no way to ever reverse that, even if they have absolute proof that it's impossible.
No, no, there is a way, and it's done regularly. A complaint is filed in the court, and generally they name the mother, and if they have an idea who the alleged father should be, they will name that person and generally also the child support agency. And blood tests are done, and the court hears it. So there is already, that is in place, and people are doing it regularly.
Well, I don't know why, but I get complaints that that system doesn't work. And in fact, you can biologically prove that's not true, and it's not in the case of adoption. It's in the case of deception, and it's not reversed. And I don't know.
I'm not aware of any case like that. I don't. Maybe Ms. Traube knows about something, but I've not heard of any case where someone has sought to disestablish paternity, has proven that he was not the father by genetic testing, and then was held to be the father. Anyway, other than there have been a couple of cases some time ago where, because of the long-standing relationship with the child and the fact that the person held himself out to the child and the world as being the father, that the court held him to that. But that's pretty rare. I haven't seen it recently.
Linda?
No, I just want to reiterate again that sometimes when people tell me you don't get the whole picture, very easily, you know, that may have been one of those cases where that person had been the father of the child for a very long time.
What does it take to do a record search in our system to find out if we have any, or to find out in what cases there was a filing to disestablish paternity that was denied, and to make sure that none of those actually were backed up with one of two things. One, adoption, foreknowledge, a contractual obligation that was taken on with knowledge, or the opposing being an actual biological determination of impossibility enforced by the court.
You would need a research analyst, because you'd have to have somebody you'd have to have a person be able to go through all the court records, because most of that would have gone to the courts and not through us.
But those records are all closed.
Well, there you go. I don't know what to say about it.
What do you mean by closed? They wouldn't be confidential. Those would be public records. The cases may be closed, but...
Okay, the record of the court case is open?
Yes. In these paternity cases and disestablishment of paternity cases, yes, the records are open.
Okay. I think they use initials when they...
Is there any way in the legal system that you can go back and just check the last 5 years of actual cases that went to court on disestablishment to make sure that... I mean, you know, I keep getting this, so I want to be able to turn around and say, no, this never happens. There was no reason to deal with it any differently than we did.
What I can do is check with all of the people, to my knowledge, all of the people who have handled child support cases for the agency in the AG's office are still in the state, and I know who they are. So I could check with the people who have done child support cases to see if anyone knows of one, but there aren't any record searches. We don't have a separate category for naming or numbering our cases that separates out the ones that involve disestablishment of paternity. But they're rare enough that I expect people would remember, most likely anyway. I mean, I could check for that kind of anecdotal information.
I would appreciate it if you would do that. You know, I would appreciate it if you'd do that. Senator Rieger?
Different subject?
Go ahead.
Question, does this law apply is the state obligated to act under this law, if this were to pass, when the
initiation of a complaint comes from a state which hasn't adopted this uniform set of statutes?
I didn't hear the beginning of the question.
Well, I guess, is this act only applicable in some kind of reciprocity fashion so that states which aren't participating in the reciprocal way don't have the ability to use this interstate compact?
In a way, that's true. The way that it is true is that there are still some states. I think we checked yesterday, and I believe the answer was there are 25 states as of now that have adopted it. And in the other 25 states that still have some version of ERISA, it is still possible that there could be another order that is being enforced despite under this UIFSA Act, one state having continuing exclusive jurisdiction. But generally, the states are trying to work with each other, and Ms. Straube may be able to speak to that better than I, but I understand that the states are working with each other and trying to apply it to the extent possible. But you are correct that in the states that haven't adopted it yet, they're not, by state law, allowed to do things exactly the same way.
Okay. Another question I have is on page 9, lines 22-23. I assume that means that the state of residence of the obligor is the state whose laws determining child support amounts is that's the prevailing state for determining child support amounts.
I didn't hear the. I'm sorry, this connection isn't that great. You're on page 9?
Yes.
At 17?
At 22.
At 22.
The question is, does that say that the state of residence of the obligor is the state whose law governs as far as determining the amount of support?
No, what that whole section, 303, does is it says, except as otherwise provided, and I can't offhand think of where the other provisions, what other provisions would apply, but when we are the responding state, that is when another state sends a case to us for enforcement, and that would usually mean that the obligor is in Alaska, then we apply their state's law on the procedural and substantive just a minute, I'm sorry. Hold on.
You didn't read that way.
I'm sorry. I was wrong. Hold on a second. Yes, you're right. It does apply. This state's law applies. When we are the responding tribunal, this state's laws apply both substantively and procedurally, and it does include under number 2 the amount of support. It's just saying that even though the petitioner may live in Ohio, that it's Alaska law that's going to apply to the amount of support because the obligor is here. If this is the correct state to have jurisdiction to do this, then we're going to apply our own law.
Go ahead. Even Jeff.
Well, does that mean that this substantially ups the amount? The schedule goes to 90.3 Alaska schedule on a order coming from Missouri?
It could be more or it could be less. That's correct.
Is there any state that's more than Alaska?
Pardon me?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, we are we're almost to the middle, but we're a little just short of the middle of the scale.
Senator Reeder?
Okay, the last question, and again, I guess everyone brings in the constituent complaints they've had, so just one, since I have you both here to ask a question. Are child support orders modified routinely or permissively or whatever when the income of the custodial parent changes, or is it only modified to kind of parallel the changes up and down in the income of the obligor?
It depends. If it is if it's joint custody, then you're going to take into account both incomes. But if, for instance, you have an obligor who wants to modify, they have to come in, we have to do the whole process with them, and by the time we're done, in order to get a modification, It's got to make a 15% difference in the child support amount either way before it's modified. And that's in 90.3, those guidelines.
That's a, what you're speaking to is a petition by the obligor to modify.
Or obligee.
Either way.
Either way.
Direction, but it isn't symmetrical. If the income of the obligee changes, can the obligor petition for a modification?
No, because the guidelines is set by the income of the obligor. However, keep in mind, those guidelines were set assuming that the obligee also spent 20% of their income for one child and 27% of their income for two children. It is the income of the obligor that has to change unless it's joint custody.
You know, I don't know if we want to get into
legal,
it.
Legal, joint, physical. Joint, physical.
Joint. the attorney needs to, I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong terminology. It's, I think it's called shared physical custody. Is that what it is?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And there also is a provision in 90.3 for the court to apply the guidelines or the agency to apply the guidelines, not follow the guidelines precisely. When there's some reason, for instance, if the child has some kind of income, or if the obligee parent has a tremendous income or something, there are ways for the guidelines to be varied.
I don't know how far we'll get into it, but I can tell you that seems to be, at least recently, the gist of the complaints that I've gotten is that the custodial parent remarries, they're making more income than the two of them combined ever did before, and still the obligor is paying, you know, 40 or 50% of the obligor's income to that family that really has no need at all anymore.
Actually, we do not also take into account if the obligor remarries, we don't take into account. Let's say the obligor is a he, we don't take into account her income either. I mean, so you're talking about the obligee remarrying and having more income in the family, and we don't take that into account, but on the same hand, we don't take into account that he may have remarried, he or she may have remarried, and that there is additional income in that family. We do not count the other spouse's income either way.
Well, you can, since at least in the past, maybe it's changing, since generally the obligor is male and the obligee is a female, it tends to have been the case that the custodial relationship has gone with the female. So that, in practice, has turned out to be a biased, what seems at the on the surface to be uniform application.
Well, the courts say that regardless of, unless somebody wants to give up their child for adoption and have the other spouse be allowed to adopt them, the new spouse, the courts, the general, the federal government says, this is your child. Regardless of whether or not there's now a step family, this is your child, this is your responsibility, regardless of what that income is. And it is true that women make less income than men on the whole. However, you will find many obligors who marry somebody else who's a nicely paid state worker. But no, it will marry somebody with a decent income also, and that doesn't make any bit of difference in how much they have to pay for child support.
Senator Sharp.
I guess we're beating this dead horse to death, but again, I've received long dissertations. I think the last one I got from someone in Palmer, or maybe your district, that said that was complaining about his child support obligations going up. He had remarried, had two kids of a second marriage to take care of. All of a sudden, they doubled the amount that he had to pay for child support for his others, what made him unable to even support the family he had.
Well,
I've got it in my file. I'll give it to you, but I can't substantiate it, but it sounds like
that's what you hear. Yeah.
That the administratively that the division or department has the right to go in and change the amounts practically at will if there's a without considering the changes of and responsibilities of the obligor overall.
Well,
You either take care of all of them, or you put them in jeopardy. You're not taking care of the ones that they have at the current time.
Right? You're speaking to a second family then?
Yes.
That occurs? Yes. We hear a lot about the second family issue, as do all of you.
Probably from the second spouse.
As a matter of fact, that is usually who...
When they come to testify, they're madder than anyone else.
Yes.
This whole process.
Yes, I'm sure they are. And there may be some dynamics there that go beyond money.
Yeah, right.
However, again, the courts, it's just like any of us here. We have children, I have a child, I know how much money I make, I know that I can't afford to go have another child. And so the courts say you need to, you know, in essence, de facto, that you need to take a look, as you have more children, can you support them? And if people go on to have second and third, and in some cases we have people that go on to have the fourth family, that with each one, they say, here is the original child, this is what you knew that you had before, you've gone to have more. However, if it will warm everyone's heart, that Civil Rule 90.3 has been, there have been some changes this year that will go into effect July 15th, and it will allow a little more leeway in taking into consideration, in exceptional cases, second families.
Yeah, but you're talking about a situation where the obligation did not, the amount of money did not change, was not ordered to be changed by the department. You know, that the...
We only...
Talk about where it was increased after the second family.
Well...
You say that don't happen?
Why that happened could have been a coincidence, but why would that happen unless he got he was making twice as much money, or... We still have cases where somebody may have, under the old rules, there was no 90.3 many years ago. People were getting $50 and $100 a month for a child. If they came in to modify under 90.3, yes, then it went to 20% of their income. So that may be the case, but we did not take the second spouse or the second girlfriend or spouse's income into account. So why that went up, I wouldn't know, other than they either increased their income or the child support was so low previously.
But, and you don't take into account the responsibilities of current children, of the current family. When you just consider the responsibility of the original family and the current family, that will take the hindmost, then, right? If the wages go up.
Well, actually, the courts, and particularly with the revised 90.3, may very well be looking more at that. But if you're asking in general, if somebody can go and have a second and third and fourth family, if they're automatically going to have to pay less, no, that won't be the case. But there will be an opportunity for them to come in and show good reason why this is different than maybe going off and having 10 more children and disregarding the first.
I'm not talking about paying less, I'm talking about paying more.
Well, if somebody's asking for a modification, then they can argue that modification and argue against it.
Does the department do modifications of the ordered amount outside of the court system?
We can only modify, at this date, we can only modify those orders which we administratively established. The court modifies
How do you administratively establish an order? I mean, how does that, maybe I...
We use the exact same guidelines that the...
The court system establishes an order at the time of, you know, in the custody, the divorce, the property settlement, and the child support order all come out in the same process. Where do you get a case where the department establishes an order?
Because there are many people who are never married and have children. Usually, if you have a divorce, you usually have a process. But, however, occasionally, you'll have a judge that just, Marilyn, correct me on this, but I think sometimes you'll have a judge that says, you know, you've got to have it according to 90.3, and then we're the ones that have to do the machinations on it. But usually, they come to us because they've never been married, is the most likely scenario.
Is it easier to change your order or the court's order?
I think it's the same. It's a matter of how long it takes.
Does it take longer to change your order or the court's order?
It depends on the court's docket, but right now, I believe, this is sadly to say, we sometimes advise people quietly that you may want to also go file with the court to see if, because they can also take an administrative order and modify it with the court. We say you may want to start with the court and just see who gets there first. Because we are, because of all the requests for modifications and the now the federal requirements of having to review every AFDC case every 3 years, it's now taking us 9 to 10 months to modify orders. You have graciously given us new employees that are coming on board to try and help with that, to decrease that backlog. But there is no set amount of times that people can come to us to modify. We have cases where people are mad at each other and they use us as the middle ground and they modify, and a month later we get another request to modify, and we're like a tennis ball.
Do you ever retroactively change the amount due?
We cannot retroactively modify orders.
Either your own or the court.
Yeah, the court is very clear about this, and the federal government. However, what we've been trying to do, and what also the new changes in 90.3 will allow, is an earlier date. Maybe Marilyn can explain this better, but basically it's calling the it's identifying the date of the modification process earlier than before. Marilyn, I'm not answering that
generally,
question.
Generally, I think the earliest that an order can be modified is the date of the motion to modify. Anything prior to that would be a retroactive modification normally, and that's not allowed. So when the motion to modify is filed or served on the other party, then that would be the beginning date of the new amount once it's
I would think with that kind of delay, there would be room for someone to take a very high-paying job for 6 or 8 months and then quit before the order ever gets to a determination, and be back for the last couple of months on a minimum income or unemployment, and do that cycle fairly effectively.
Well, there isn't a trick out there that they haven't figured out. Basically, what we do though is we go back to the date that that all parties were notified. So if it's taking us 9 months, we're warning these parties that, and the other side has to know that, you know, you need to be aware that when we're able to finally do the modification, we're going to go back to the date of when you were first told that may occur. So, and again, we go by whatever financial information they have at the time of our determination. So what they do in the meantime of everything is what they do.
Senator Sharp?
I guess I'm getting more confused the more I hear. This little blurb from the Department of Revenue, it says what these two bills, or this bill is going to do. It says it recognizes the speed and efficiency of administrative action to establish, modify, or enforce a child support order without having to go through the court. So, you know, I guess I was always under the impression that to establish child support, you had to get a court order.
No.
So administratively, this can all be done without ever
going to court. Yeah, that's the reason for all my questions on the paternity, because the whole system can go on its own and can create huge long-term obligations.
But we use the same 90.3 guidelines that the court uses. These are the guidelines that we use.
So we're assuming an equal amount of fairness and equal protection that the agency would use, the same as the court would use it.
Right. I know that there is some perception.
Well, trust me.
I know there is some perception that we are one. I know there is perception that we are one-sided, but you need to remember that the person having to pay almost always feels that way. But if it's any consolation and it's a shame for us, we have equal numbers of obligee angry at us as we do obligors.
We have We have, I think, gone through the at least the questions, but we've lost our quorum. What we're going to do is come back. We have to come back on 1:48 at 2 o'clock, and we'll probably come back at 1 or 1:30 if we've got, what is it, Senate Bill 130 ready to go. They're still out there arguing. They may have had to go outside of the state to get the rest of their arguers out of it.
Sure.
Senator Jarrah.
I just had a couple questions.